Good morning, Crosspoint. Good morning, everyone else who might have joined in. This is part three of our series on the Bible story of Queen Esther. Now, we had some pretty wild weather this past week just gone. Tuesday evening, there was a storm. Trees were blown down and some people lost their power for quite a long time and small businesses had to close. There was chaos for the commuters in the city. Things were not good. And then on Wednesday morning, I was out early driving the work van from my other job, and some of the traffic lights still weren't working and there were still tree branches beside the road. I could see the effects of the storm. But looking to the east, I could see a bank of clouds. I could not see the sun, but I could see the rays of the sun coming out from behind the cloud. So I knew the sun was there. I knew the sun would soon be shining again, despite the storm. And it reminded me of this story of Queen Esther, where we left off the story last week. So just to recap, in week one, we read that King Xerxes had a big party, and at the end of the party, the king wanted Queen Vashti to appear before all his officials so they could all see how beautiful she was. But the queen declined the invitation and refused to attend, and so she was banished from the presence of the king and quite possibly executed for the crime of disobeying the king. So then they wanted a new queen, so they had a beauty pageant of sorts where lots of young women were brought to the king, and he chose Esther as his new queen. Then we read that a man called Mordecai had overheard a plot to assassinate the king. Now, Mordecai was Esther's adopted father, and Mordecai told Esther about this plot. Esther told the king. There was an investigation, and the two men were, uncovered, found guilty, put to death, and the king's life was saved. And that whole episode of how Mordecai had saved the king's life was recorded in their history books. That was week one. Last week, in week two, we read about a man called Haman. Haman wasn't a very nice fella, but he had become the second most powerful man in the empire after the king. Everyone was ordered to bow down to Haman whenever he walked past, but Mordecai refused to bow down to Haman, which made Haman very angry. Now, Mordecai was a Jew. Esther also was a Jew, although people in the palace did not know that yet. But Mordecai was a Jew, but to punish Mordecai, Haman decided that he wanted to kill all of the Jews, not just Mordecai. So Haman persuaded the king to pass a law that said all Jews must be killed on a particular day. And they chose a day that was early the following year, so less than a year away. Now, when Mordecai heard this news, like many of the Jews, he went into mourning and grieving because they'd all received a death sentence. And Mordecai asked Esther to go and talk to the king to ask for mercy on behalf of her people. Now, Esther knew that anyone who entered the king's presence uninvited could be put to death. But despite the risks, she agreed to go to the king. But first, she asked all the Jews in Susa to fast and to pray for her. And so their situation at the end of the chapter last week was quite grim, just like the weather this week. All the Jews are about to be killed. They're going to be exterminated in less than a year. It certainly looked like there was no hope and no way out. And they knew God was there. They were hoping God would intervene in their situation. But just like the weather this week, they could not see the sun. They just hoped that he would intervene. And sometimes in situations, all we can see is clouds, isn't it? Or we can only see the clouds and the effects of the storm. And things were certainly looking pretty bad at the end of chapter 4 last week. So now we'll get to Esther chapter 5. And now I'll be reading from the NLT version. You might want to follow along in whatever Bible you have at home. But we're reading from Esther chapter 5. On the third day of the fast, Esther put on her royal robes and entered the inner court of the palace just across from the king's hall. The king was sitting on his royal throne facing the entrance. So Esther has dressed carefully. She wants to please the king. She's dressed up to be attractive, and she's wearing the royal gown to remind the king of her position, her title. And there's a movie called One Night with the King that is based on the story of Esther. And one of the things the movie did really well, I think, is this scene where Esther approaches the king on his throne. And the guards see her coming and they grow tense and they're looking at each other because has she been invited? Is she supposed to be here? What do we do? And people are on their feet, swords are drawn, there's tension, there's drama, there is uncertainty. And I imagine that's pretty much how the Secret Service would react today. If someone barged into the Oval Office uninvited, it would be the same. There would be, you know, high drama of what to do. And for Queen Esther, this was literally a life or death moment. Her life depends on the reaction of the king. It's like a game of Russian roulette. This could go either way. Now, if this was a novel, they would drag out this moment for a whole chapter. But this is the Bible. It's not there for excitement. It's just there to record the events. So in the Bible, this whole event takes just two sentences. And verse 2 says, when the king saw Queen Esther standing there in the inner court, he welcomed her and held out the gold scepter to her. So Esther approached and touched the end of the scepter. And we all breathe a sigh of relief because Esther has survived. Esther is still alive. So one potential disaster has been averted, which is good news. However, the Jewish people are not out of the woods. The bigger challenge still lies ahead. The whole reason why Esther had to approach the king is still there and still valid. This decree, this law, this sentence of death, this law that cannot be changed, this sentence of to extermination. So verse 3, the king asked her, what do you want, Queen Esther? What is your request? I will give it to you, even if it is half the kingdom. Now this idea of offering half the kingdom was not considered a literal promise, but it was a fairly common expression, apparently, just to convey goodwill towards the person making the request. In verse 4, Esther replied, if it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to a banquet I have prepared for the king. Now, I don't know why she invited Haman as well. Obviously, he could have disrupted her conversation with the king. The Bible doesn't tell us why he was invited, but clearly God is behind the scenes here. God is working things out. So verse 5, the king turned to his attendants and said, tell Haman to come quickly to a banquet as Esther has requested. So the king and Haman went to Esther's banquet. Banquets always sound good, don't they? They sound great, grand, expensive, extravagant. We don't know what they ate at this banquet, but it was probably delicious. In verse 6 says, while they were drinking wine, the king said to Esther, now tell me what you really want. What is your request? I will give it to you, even if it is half the kingdom. So obviously the king realises Esther hasn't risked her life walking into the throne room uninvited just to have dinner with him. Esther's obviously got something on her mind, and the king is keen to know what it is and to, you know, he's happy to grant her request. But in verse 7, Esther replies, this is my request and my deepest wish. If I have found favour with the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my request and do what I ask, please come with Haman tomorrow to the banquet I will prepare for you. And then I will explain what this is all about. Now, we don't know why Esther waited again. Maybe she's just still a little bit nervous. She doesn't know how the king's going to respond, and so maybe she just feels she just needs to keep waiting for just the right moment. Because asking a human authority for any request, especially a big request, is always a risk. You never know how they're going to respond, because human beings are always subject to moods. Humans have agendas. Humans can sometimes play favourites. We don't know how our request will be received. Now, as Christian people, we are incredibly blessed that we can take our requests to God at any time. We can enter the throne room of God in prayer and ask him for what we need. And Hebrews chapter 4, verse 16 says, let us then approach God's throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. That's a very encouraging promise, and a great reassurance that we can approach God. God is the same yesterday and today and forever. He doesn't play favourites. He doesn't change. God always keeps his promises. So we can approach God with confidence. But Esther, approaching King Xerxes, there was probably still some nerves there for her. And back to the story, and in verse 9 says that Haman was a happy man as he left the banquet. Now you can imagine how he was feeling. You know, life is pretty good. He's just been invited, just him, to dine with the king and the queen. Now, he's already an important man, he's rich, he's powerful. Haman probably thought he had it all. And verse 9 continues, but when he saw Mordecai sitting at the palace gate, not standing up or trembling nervously before him, Haman became furious. See, Haman, his whole self-esteem seems to rest on other people's opinion of him. And it's a very flaky thing to put your, you know, to build your self-esteem on. But verse 10 says, however, he restrained himself and went on home. Then Haman gathered together his friends and Zeresh, his wife, and boasted to them about his great wealth and his many children. He bragged about the honours the king had given him and how he had been promoted over all the other nobles and officials. So Haman's just boasting to his wife and his friends here. They already know this stuff. Obviously, his wife knows how many children they have. His friends know, you know, his important position. But Haman, he's just boosting his own ego, reminding himself of how important it is. The Bible has a lot to say about pride, and the Bible warns us against pride. Proverbs chapter 16, verse 5 says, the Lord detests all those proud of heart. Be sure of this, they will not go unpunished. And Proverbs 16, verse 18 also says, pride goes before destruction. So we all need to avoid the trap of pride. But verse 12 says, Haman then added, and that's not all. Queen Esther invited only me and the king himself to the banquet she prepared for us. And she has invited me to dine with her and the king again tomorrow. And then he added, but this is all worth nothing as long as I see Mordecai the Jew just sitting there at the palace gate. So Haman's wife Zeresh and all his friends suggested, set up a sharpened pole that stands 75 feet tall. And in the morning, ask the king to impale Mordecai on it. When this is done, you can go on your merry way to the banquet with the king. This pleased Haman, so he ordered the pole to be set up. Now notice, Haman does not yet have the king's permission to, you know, stick Mordecai on this pole to kill him, but he sets up the pole anyway. And you might have noticed in the previous chapter that Haman had already chosen the day when the Jews would be exterminated, even before he had gone to the king and asked for permission to do it. So Haman is getting a little bit ahead of himself here. So just to summarize this chapter. So Esther, she went to the king uninvited, but she survived that first hurdle. The king welcomed her. The king and Haman went to her banquet. They're coming back tomorrow for another banquet. But the Jews are still sentenced to die. And there's actually even worse news now for Mordecai, because although he does not know it, Haman is planning to put him to death tomorrow morning. So that's the end of chapter 5. Let's get into chapter 6, which starts off saying, that night the king had trouble sleeping. So he ordered an attendant to bring the book of the history of his reign so it could be read to him. That very night, the king could not sleep. Is this a coincidence? Well, I think not. I think God is at work here. We don't know why he couldn't sleep that night, but he just happened to suffer from insomnia. And he asked to have this book of the history of his reign to be read to him. In one of the Bible commentaries I read about this says that people who have discovered and read these historical records say they're about as exciting as, you know, reading income tax regulations. They're not fun, they're not exciting, they're just records of events. This is probably the king's version of counting sleep. Like, please read this to me so I can be bored enough that I can finally get to sleep. But this night, instead of putting him to sleep, we read in verse 2, in those records he discovered an account of how Mordecai had exposed the plot of Bigthana and Teresh, two of the eunuchs who guarded the door to the king's private quarters. They had plotted to assassinate King Xerxes. What reward or recognition did we ever give to Mordecai for this? The king asks. And his attendants replied, nothing has been done for him. Now, kings like to reward those who serve them well. obviously, firstly, because this will encourage others also to serve them. But if a man saves the king's life and he's not rewarded, the king might be thinking, well, what if someone else overhears a plot? Is he even going to bother to report it and save my life? Or will he think, what's the point? So it's very important to the king that people are rewarded for, you know, civic duties like this. And the king realizes now Mordecai is owed a reward and he wants to do something about it. So as usual in these situations, the king likes to get advice from one of his advisors. So verse 4, "Who is that in the outer court?" the king inquired. And as it happened, Haman had just arrived in the outer court of the palace to ask the king to impale Mordecai on the pole that he had prepared. So the attendants replied to the king, "Haman is out in the court." "Bring him in," the king ordered. So Haman came in, and the king said, "What should I do to honour a man who truly pleases me?" Now, I think God has placed these two men together at this precise moment. They both have vastly different moods and expectations right now. Haman has been boasting about his greatness. His mind is full of thoughts of revenge. And he is here. He's planning to manipulate the king to give him what he wants, which is to kill Mordecai. Now Xerxes, he's looking for help to find an appropriate reward for someone who has served him so well. And neither of them mention Mordecai by name, but both of them are actually thinking about Mordecai, but in different ways. Now verse 6 continues, "Haman thought to himself, 'Whom would the king wish to honour more than me?'" You know, this is a symptom of Haman's pride, isn't it? It never seems to cross his mind that maybe, just maybe, there might be someone else in this vast empire who also pleases the king. But Haman just assumes it's all about him. So Haman replied in verse 7, if the king wishes to honour someone, he should bring out one of the king's own royal robes, as well as a horse that the king himself has ridden, one with a royal emblem on its head. Let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials, and let him see that the man whom the king wishes to honour is dressed in the king's robes and led through the city square on the king's horse. Have the officials shout as they go, 'This is what the king does for someone he wishes to honour.'" So the king has just been thinking about how to reward a man who saved his life, which is no small thing. And there's been a delay in giving this reward, so the king is probably quite happy to be a little bit extra generous and more extravagant. And then in walks Haman, who's not there to serve the king. Haman's thinking about his own agenda. And the king mentions a reward for someone he wishes to honour, and Haman is immediately assumed the king wants to honour him. So Haman now devises this grand scheme. A king's robe, a king's horse, a king's official, a public parade through the streets. All of this is designed for Haman to make Haman look important, to tell everyone how important Haman is, how much the king loves Haman. And it is a creative idea, obviously a little misguided, but it is quite a creative idea. And the king loves the idea. Verse 10, "Excellent," the king said to Haman. "Quick, take the robes and my horse and do just as you have said. For Mordecai, the Jew who sits at the gate of the palace, leave out nothing you have suggested." Now, we can only imagine Haman's thoughts at that very moment. There must have been a slap in the face. You know, first of all, not only is this reward not for him, which he had imagined, but it's actually for Mordecai, the man that he hates, the man that he detests, the man that he is plotting to kill. And even worse, now Haman, has to be the one who leads this parade in Mordecai's honour. This could not possibly be any worse for Haman. And of course, he cannot disobey the king. That would be unthinkable. So Haman's dream has just turned into a nightmare. The tables have turned big time in this story. And verse 11 says, "So Haman took the robes and put them on Mordecai, placed him on the king's own horse, and led him through the city square, shouting, 'This is what the king does for someone he wishes to honour. Now again, we need to use our imagination thinking about this scene. I guess first of all, the surprise for Mordecai when Haman must have approached him with a great horse and a beautiful robe and said, come with me, sit up here. And Mordecai starts telling the whole city how much the king wants to honour Mordecai. It must have been a bit of a surprise for Mordecai. But also, all of the palace officials, who they knew that Mordecai wouldn't bow down to Haman, they knew how much Haman hated Mordecai because of that. So they must have been laughing behind Haman's back at how now he has to shout out and tell everyone how great Mordecai was and how much the king loves Mordecai. Oh boy, we can only imagine. But certainly we read on in verse 12, says, afterwards, Mordecai returned to the palace gate, but Haman hurried home, dejected and completely humiliated. When Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends what had happened, his wise advisers and his wife said, since Mordecai, this man who has humiliated you, is of Jewish birth, you will never succeed in your plans against him. It will be fatal to continue opposing him. Which is interesting, isn't it? They had already known Mordecai was Jewish, and yet just a day earlier they were telling him, yeah, go ahead and kill Mordecai, and they probably knew about this plot to wipe out the Jews. And now they're saying, oh yeah, you can't go up against Jewish people, that won't end well. So they could have given him this advice a day earlier, couldn't they? It might have saved Haman from himself. But they didn't. But the Bible does give a warning. Psalm 2 warns against people who plot against God's people. It says that their ways will lead to destruction. And we can see that in Haman, and I think Haman is probably starting to realise by now that this is not his day. Things have not gone according to script for him. Things are not going well. And then verse 14, maybe this was a bright ray of sunshine again for Haman. While they were still talking, the king's eunuchs arrived and quickly took Haman to the banquet Esther had prepared. So things have certainly turned around very quickly in this story. And Esther has not yet made her request to the king. But God has already intervened and to create the perfect time for her to do so. You know, people prayed for 3 days. The Jews were fasting and praying before Esther went to the king. Clearly, God has heard their prayers. God is answering their prayers. It's a very good reminder for us of just how important and how powerful prayer can be. And God likes to involve us, his people, in his plans. Obviously, God can do things without us, but God likes to include us, and all we need to do is be obedient to God and be faithful to God. And God can do some incredible things, extraordinary things. And God is definitely working in this situation. And there might be times in our life when all we can see is the clouds. We might be walking through a storm or still seeing the effects of the storm afterwards, and maybe we cannot see God working. But that does not mean God's not there. It does not mean God is not working. Romans chapter 8, verse 28 says, we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. In all things, in all circumstances, in all situations, God is working. God works things out. And we need to give credit where it's due. Give the credit to God. It's not the circumstances that work themselves out. The universe doesn't work things out. The stars don't work things out. Very rarely does the government work things out. It is God who works things out. And God works all things for the good of those who love him according to his purpose. Does that mean God works all things out for people like Haman who ignore him and reject him? No, God works things out for the good of people who love him, who are called according to his purpose. And in this chapter, we've certainly seen God was working to save his people. And God can do the same in our circumstances. And no matter how bad our storms may seem, God can still work in our circumstances. That's the end of chapter 6. Now we get to chapter 7, which is in some ways the climax of part of the story, although certainly not the end of the story just yet. But chapter 7, verse 1. So the king and Haman went to Queen Esther's banquet. On this second occasion, while they were drinking wine, the king again said to Esther, tell me what you want, Queen Esther. What is your request? I will give it to you, even if it is half the kingdom. This is the third time now that King Xerxes has offered to give Esther whatever she wants, up to half the kingdom. And now Esther replies in verse 3. Queen Esther replied, "If I have found favour with the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my request, I ask that my life and the lives of my people will be spared. For my people and I have been sold to those who would kill, slaughter, and annihilate us. If we had merely been sold as slaves, I could remain quiet, for that would be too trivial a matter to warrant disturbing the king." So notice how Esther words this request. If I have found favour. Well, of course Esther has found favour. The king chose her from among, you know, a myriad of beautiful young women. And she says, if it pleased the king, and I think there's a good chance that it will please the king to save the life of his queen, his wife. But Esther's humble and polite and tactful and respectful towards the king. Esther does not specify who her people are. Haman had never specified which group of people he wanted to kill. But Esther does use the same words as Haman had used in the edict, in the law. Kill, slaughter, annihilate. I think these words illustrate the brutality and the finality of this situation. And the king is upset. "Who would do such a thing?" King Xerxes demanded. "Who would be so presumptuous as to touch you?" You know, King Xerxes had, until now, never really taken the time to find out who these people were who were going to be killed. It was just some vague group that was causing some undefined problem somewhere in the empire, and he hadn't been too concerned about the details. But now he's suddenly about to discover that this new law is actually going to have an impact very, very close to home. And Esther replied, "This wicked Haman is our adversary and our enemy." Haman grew pale with fright before the king and the queen. Again, Esther's words are very well chosen. She says, "This wicked Haman is our adversary." Esther explains that Haman is inadvertently plotting against them as a couple, against the king and the queen. Haman's new law is going to separate them, to divide them, to come between them. Verse 7 says, "The king jumped to his feet in a rage and went out into the palace garden." Now, the king does need a minute to think, because this is a tricky situation for him, to be fair. He's promised three times to grant Esther's request, but Haman's his 2IC. Haman's his right-hand man. Whatever the king does, he could lose face here. He can't deny the request now after promising Esther three times that he would grant it. But he also can't backtrack on this law that he had approved. His own signet ring had been used to confirm this law. So what is he going to do? Well, verse 7 continues. It says, "Haman, however, stayed behind to plead for his life with Queen Esther, for he knew that the king intended to kill him. In despair, he fell on the couch where Queen Esther was reclining, just as the king was returning from the palace garden." Now, at the very start of this series, you might recall that I mentioned how God's timing is always perfect. God's timing can be to the exact day, to the exact minute, and even when necessary, to the exact second. And it's true in this chapter. Haman, the king, could not sleep on this particular day, just the day when God wanted to remind him about Mordecai. That was the night he couldn't sleep and the book was read to him, just that day. And then Haman had walked into the court at the exact minute when the king was looking for advice. And now it is the precise second as Haman is throwing himself on the couch with Queen Esther to plead for his life when the king walks back in. And we don't know exactly what happened, but obviously it looked pretty bad. And that seals the deal. Haman is doomed. Verse 8, the king exclaimed, "Will he even assault the queen right here in the palace before my eyes?" And as soon as the king spoke, his attendants covered Haman's face, signaling his doom. And then Harbona, one of the king's eunuchs, said, Haman has set up a sharpened pole that stands 75 feet tall in his own courtyard. He intended to use it to impale Mordecai, the man who saved the king from assassination. Then impale Haman on it, the king ordered. So they impaled Haman on the pole that he had set up for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided. It's funny how Harbona chooses just this precise moment to tell the king some interesting info. Hey, by the way, did you know that Haman set up a pole to kill the man who saved your life? You know, the king was already angry at that moment, and that was just provided the perfect way to vent his anger. Impale Haman on his own pole. And that makes the king's decision easy, you know, as in his dilemma of what to do and how not to lose face. Well, Haman is disgraced. Haman is dead. So it's interesting, isn't it? First of all, Haman had to give Mordecai the honour that he had dreamed up for himself. But now Haman suffers the death that he had planned for Mordecai. How quickly things can turn around. You know, just one day before this, Haman was invited to a banquet with the king and the queen, and he was boasting about all his success. He was going to kill his enemy, Mordecai. And now, less than a day later, he's been publicly humiliated and he's been sentenced to death. What a difference a day can make. And the turning point for this whole story was a sleepless night for the king. Couldn't sleep, so he asked someone to read for him, and they just happened to read the page that God wanted him to remember. And everything turned on that moment. You know, we can make the best plans in life. We can lay it all out, do everything right, just as Esther had done. Esther had a plan, but we need God. Esther knew she needed prayer support. She was very wise to ask people to be praying for her. And Esther was brave. She was faithful. She was tactful. Esther did her best, and God did the rest. Of course, this story is not over yet. You know, there is still this law that has been made. The law of the Medes and the Persians could never be changed, and this law has been decreed that all Jews must die. So there was still a problem to solve. But the enemy, the antagonist, the chief conspirator against the Jews, Haman, is now dead, disgraced and dead. He's out of the equation. How will the rest of the problem be solved? Well, that's what we'll discuss when we finish the story next week. Hope you can join us then.